This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 212, was recorded on March 26th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by TopTradersOnPlug.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases, and by my own vacation rental property on the coast of Maine, which I'm repurposing as a COVID-19 safe haven for families who want to escape city life for a few months during this crisis. It's been said that in finance, there are decades when nothing happens and weeks when decades happen. This has been a week when decades happened. Monday morning saw the biggest monetary policy intervention in world history, with the U.S. Federal Reserve embarking on a new program of quantitative easing with an unlimited asset purchase budget. Then on Wednesday evening, the Senate unanimously passed the biggest fiscal policy intervention in U.S. history in the form of a $2 trillion fiscal stimulus deal. The bill had not passed in the House of Representatives when we taped today's podcast, but imminent passage is widely expected. Meanwhile, President Trump has announced aggressive plans to begin reopening the U.S. economy by Easter, but several signs suggest he may be losing the confidence of his medical advisors, with Dr. Anthony Fauci commenting in a separate television interview that you don't get to set the timeline because the virus sets the timeline. So what does all of this mean for markets? Are all the ingredients in place to drive a sustained recovery from here? Or would it be more accurate to say that both epic monetary and epic fiscal stimulus are now fully priced in, leaving the government with no further ammunition to support asset markets should they fall farther from here? Variant Perception co-founder Simon White joins me to answer that question as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss the situation and what it means for the market outlook in coming weeks and months. And be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment. Patrick has prepared another of his famous post-game chart decks to talk us through where we currently stand in the evolution of the market's reaction to these historic events.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, before we even get to the coronavirus update in markets, let's start with this week's historic monetary and fiscal stimulus interventions. What happened? What does it mean?
Well, Monday at 8 a.m., the Fed announced unlimited quantitative easing to begin immediately. And it expressly includes buying corporate bonds in addition to treasury bonds. Now, in my opinion, that undermines the intention of the Federal Reserve Act. They did some fancy footwork and figured out a way to kind of follow the letter of the law, if not the intent of the law. I think they want to include buying stocks, but in order to do that, they're going to need an actual act of Congress. A lot of people thought they needed an act of Congress just to buy corporate bonds, but they seem to be doing that, making up their own rules, if you will. In perspective, QE2 was that great big controversial quantitative easing program that spent $500 billion in just 8 months. And it was considered very, very controversial at the time because that was a heck of a lot of money. The Fed spent more than $500 billion so far this week, and they've said that their intention is to continue spending more than the size of QE2 every single week, starting this week, next week, and the week after that, indefinitely. Then on Wednesday evening, the Senate passed a $2 trillion fiscal stimulus bill. The House is expected to pass it. We had Bernie Sanders, and you know, I never, Patrick, in 3 million years would have thought that I would say this on the show, but I'm actually in agreement with Bernie Sanders, who says, hey, wait a minute, what's with all this corporate welfare? Why are we bailing out the cruise ship industry? The private jet industry wants a bailout. This doesn't make any sense. I think for the first time in my life, I agree completely with Bernie Sanders, but nobody else seems to see it that way. So once we get past Bernie's objections, passage of this $2 trillion stimulus is expected from the House, and of course the president is waiting to sign it. There's no apparent concern for who eventually is going to pay for all of these bailouts. And, you know, why the heck are we bailing out the cruise ship industry? I sure don't get it, Patrick.
Now, let's touch on the coronavirus situation. Once again, you produced a full hour-long coronavirus update podcast that we released Tuesday morning featuring Lenore Hawkins reporting from Northern Italy and Dr. Steve Bickel reporting from Florida, which is now becoming quite the hotspot for the coronavirus. Listeners can find that podcast free of charge on our homepage at macrovoices.com. But Eric, what has changed since that Tuesday morning when you recorded that?
Well, a whole lot has changed. First of all, there was a lot of news reports that maybe Italy is starting to peak in terms of new infections. That was a great sign of relief. But now, after today's numbers, it seems like maybe they're not peaking after all. Maybe there's another wave in Italy. The U.S. and the rest of the world, of course, is considerably behind Italy, so there's still plenty of time to go before anyone else gets to a peak. There's a really important article that came out the end of last week called The Hammer and the Dance. And we have it linked in your research roundup email, or you can just Google Hammer and Dance. Briefly, it's not really new information, but I think it's the most concise, well-written article to date, laying out what the real challenge is that we face and why it's so important. The metaphor of the hammer and the dance says basically what's needed right now is a really, really big, strong policy action, locking things down, getting people to just stay home and not interact with other people to get this viral outbreak under control. So that's the hammer part. The dance is then once you get R-naught, which is that transmissivity index that measures the contagion of the virus, once you get that down below one, where you're not growing the size of the epidemic anymore, the dance is how do you start to reopen the economy while doing it in a careful way that doesn't push R-naught back above one to the point where the epidemic goes out of control again. Quite frankly, President Trump wants to go straight to the dance without suffering the pain of the hammer, and I think that that is going to end very, very badly. I don't think that the governors and mayors of the country are going to allow it. I think they'll take matters into their own hand and impose their own hammers where they're necessary if the federal government is not going to stand up and lead the way. And I'm convinced, Patrick, the reason for today's 200 S&P point rally was because of news coming out that Professor Neil Ferguson had supposedly admitted that he was wrong and changed his mind about the report that was very widely circulated a couple of weeks ago. Now, if you dive into this, he's not really wrong about anything. What he is reporting is that he now believes that the virus is even more contagious than previously thought, and therefore already more people have it than previously thought. Now, he's saying that this may lead to a different set of expectations around how long of a lockdown is needed in order to get us through this. There were a lot of reports out that seemed to imply that what this means is we're not going to have any problem with overwhelming the healthcare system. I don't think that's accurate. I think that Professor Ferguson is right that the R-naught value is higher than he thought it was. It's not just 2.5. It's at least 3, maybe 4, or even 6. That means that this is even more dangerous and we need a hammer even more than ever. It may mean that we're closer to herd immunity than previously thought, but I don't think it's cause for the huge amount, you know, the 200 S&P point rally that happened in reaction to it. I don't think it's really cause for that. So restarting the economy by Easter, as President Trump wants to do, in my opinion, would be a grave mistake that would ultimately cost thousands of lives. Because if you rush things, as Dr. Anthony Fauci said later in a separate interview, you know, the virus controls the timeline. You don't get to set the timeline. The virus sets the timeline. I don't think President Trump is going to stay the course. I think he was just trying to provide reassurance. Maybe he'll come to his senses. If not, the governors and mayors will impose their own hammers. But we need the hammer. before we can get to the dance. And I really encourage you, if there's just one article that you read about this crisis, it's The Hammer and the Dance. We're still in the exponential growth stage. Predictably, the numbers are going to get a lot worse from here. We haven't even gotten to the point of overwhelming our healthcare system in the United States. I still think it's coming. And I don't think that Professor Ferguson's announcements, I mean, just look at what's going on in Italy and Spain. They're having to triage to the point of literally cutting people over a certain age off from life support, giving them sedatives and allowing them to die because they don't have enough equipment to respond to this crisis. So there's no reason to assume we're not going to see the same things in the United States, but people seem to want to interpret Professor Ferguson's statements this morning to mean that. And I don't think that's correct. So I think this big rally is going to come back out of the market pretty soon. If we don't have the hammer now, if we try to reopen the economy by Easter, it's just going to make the problem worse and it's going to take longer to ultimately recover. The reality of the situation is not plan to restart the economy by Easter, but rather prepare for the reality of triage, having to not be able to help all of the people in the United States that need medical care and being forced to cut some of them off and allow them to die because you can't help everybody. That's what's already happening in Italy and Spain, and I don't think Professor Ferguson's new views are going to change that for the United States. I still think it's coming. I am going to change my market view, though. I had previously said I don't think that the market bottoms until the end of May, which would coincide with really the peak hospital overload. The thing is, it's more likely now that I've reevaluated my view. I think the market probably bottoms when we hit peak infections, new infections on a daily basis. Peaking is probably in the end of April. So I think the market bottom comes a little earlier than I previously predicted. But, you know, if we go through this Easter Bunny nonsense and delay the hammer, it's going to take longer and it's going to be much worse. So it depends a little bit on policy from here.
All right, well, let's move on to the S&P 500 because we're going 3-4 trading sessions off of the low. We're testing 2,600 on the top end in the S&P 500. This bounce is definitely underway, and it's probably going to lead to another short, but where do you think this is going?
Well, what a week, Patrick. We have been, you know, we started locked limit down at 2174 on Sunday night because based on the weekend news with the virus reports getting worse, you know, over the weekend, everybody seemed to be thinking, okay, it can only go down from here. Then, of course, Monday morning, you get the Fed announcing, astonishingly, the biggest monetary policy intervention in recorded history. We're going to do a bigger QE than all of QE2 every single week from here out. And the market, of course, goes straight up. The really amazing thing, Patrick, and I think this is such strong evidence that the Fed put has finally expired. That big spike up in asset prices in reaction to the monetary policy announcement only lasted 2 hours before it had fully retraced. But then you get the combination of the fiscal stimulus bill and particularly President Trump telling everyone in the Monday press conference that his plan is to restart the economy by Easter and we're not really going to, you know, it's not going to affect us. It can't happen here. As Dr. Fauci says, you don't get to set the timeline. The virus sets the timeline, and I don't think President Trump's fantasies about Easter are realistic. But that's what he's telling people. That's what the market's reacting to. And that really got the rally going. So we came off of those 2174 lows, shooting all the way up to 2400. And then it was the news this morning that I think has been misinterpreted in the way it's been reported. Professor Ferguson did change his view, but he said the virus is more contagious. It's worse than we thought. And that may mean that more people already have it. And therefore, in order to get to herd immunity, maybe you don't need the 18-month lockdown that he once thought might be necessary. That's not to say that we don't have a problem, and it's not to say that the U.S. healthcare system is not going to be overwhelmed the way Italy and Spain's healthcare systems have. So right now, I don't know how much farther we have to go. You don't get to the 38.2% retracement of this great big huge move down from 33 whatever it was until about 2642, I believe, is the 38.2 fib retracement. So that would be a good target for where this might top out. I'm not sure it's done there either. But as we get to more bad news on the virus front, I think eventually this tops out and we end up, I don't think the low is in yet. I think we're going below 2174. I think we're going to go probably to 2000 or lower before this is over. But right now, everybody's got the idea that everything's better and President Trump's going to open the economy by Easter. Ain't going to happen, folks. But for now, the market, the combination of this getting us to 2400 and then the, I think, misinterpretation of what Professor Ferguson has said got us to 2600. Do we go to 2800 on the next bit of fake news? I'm not sure. But eventually, I think we move much lower.
All right, well, let's move on to the dollar index because it's more or less been paused its advance and particularly driven by the a significant euro bounce. We have the dollar index now retracing that big breakout. Do you think this is a buy on dip on the dollar?
Well, Patrick, it would be perfectly normal to see the dollar pullback. The 104 level that it just barely touched would be the previous multi-year high. It's not an all-time high, but I think it's, I don't know how many years it goes back, bigger, more years than the chart that I've got in front of me right now. So does it break higher from here? Probably. I've made the case before, Patrick, for this global pandemic to be dollar positive. But hold on a second. We've got unlimited quantitative easing forever, upwards of $500 billion, not for the whole program, but per week for an unlimited amount of time. And that's to buy assets, including corporate bonds. And I think it's going to include stocks as soon as they can pull off the act of Congress that they need in order to include stocks as well. So this has got to be very, very dilutive to the dollar. Do we still have what I've predicted, that the dollar appreciates relative to other fiat currencies? Probably, but it depends on what other central banks do, because if they don't follow suit and it's just the Fed that's printing money like crazy, it's got to be dollar negative relative to other currencies. What I am sure of is that gold is going to outperform all fiat currencies, because we're diluting the value of the currency in order to bail out cruise ship industry and maybe the private jet industry and everybody else that seems to want or expect a bailout. $2 trillion fiscal stimulus package and unlimited monetary stimulus, that's just got to dilute the value of fiat currency, and gold is going to be the big winner. Whether or not other fiat currencies do better than the dollar or worse than the dollar, it's not as clear as it was a few weeks ago.
Let's move on to crude oil. What's going on?
Well, based on extreme weakness in RBOB gasoline, I thought we were going to get to the teens this week. But then Trump's Easter Bunny story and the dual stimulus was, you know, obviously a major bump higher. I was actually surprised we didn't get higher than we did. Then Pompeo asked Mohammed bin Salman to rise to the occasion and end the price war with Russia. MBS didn't make any commitment to do that, but the market is pricing in at least some possibility that he might. We saw some very interesting action where RBOB gasoline, which normally is a very good predictor of what crude oil is going to do next, RBOB was straight down while crude oil was straight up. The only explanation I can come up with to explain that is somebody, and I mean somebody really big, is puking crack spreads, which of course is a trade that involves opposite direction positions on crude oil and gasoline. That action seems to have ended, Patrick, and we're seeing, particularly today on Thursday, just as I've predicted on this program, the market is really breaking into a super contango condition with about $3.20 on the May-June spread. The June-July spread is about $2.50 or so. And these are numbers earlier this afternoon. I'm not looking at the screen right now. And $1.50 on the July-August spread. So we're seeing a big, big super contango developing. I think that is going to continue to get wider and wider with those time spreads blowing out to record proportions as front month prices crash. Now, they're not crashing yet. I think that's coming. We saw weakness late this afternoon in WTI crude, and I think that phenomenon is going to continue until we reach the point of peak infections in the United States, probably toward the end of April.
Well, Eric, I can tell you just from the chart on crude that the price action remains very distributive. So it'll be really interesting to see if we get into the teens by next week. Anyway, how did the EIA inventory come in this week?
Crude oil building 1.6 million barrels, not as big of a build as you would expect. You know, the whole story here is about an expectation that the storage tanks are going to fill up because of weak demand in this coronavirus crisis. 1.6 million barrels is a build on inventory, but it's not a massive one. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 858,000 barrels. Gasoline drawing down 1.5 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 679,000 barrels. How in the heck is it possible that finished products are drawing down in this environment when demand is weakening? The answer is there was a big increase in finished product exports, up 600,000 barrels this week alone. So that's what's happening, is the finished products are getting sent overseas. Why only the small builds in crude? It's coming, folks. Wait for it. I think that the market needs to see confirmation, though. A lot of people, a lot of traders are saying, wait a minute, okay, the EIA is not reporting this super huge crude oil build phenomenon that everybody was expecting. Maybe it's not really going to happen. You know, I spent a lot of time wishing that this virus thing maybe wouldn't really happen. Maybe the builds won't really happen. Well, they're coming, folks. When they do, and we actually have the numbers in front of us, I think that's what's going to cause the market to make the next major leg down. And I think in the $16 to $17 range on WTI is where we're headed, but maybe not until next week's inventory report. U.S. production ticked down just 100,000 barrels to 13 million barrels even, just below the record level that we were at previously. Imports, 6.1 million barrels. Exports, 3.9 million barrels. Tape action, well, that smaller than expected build gave us a rally, but frankly, it was a rally that didn't even get us to the previous overnight low, and it just barely got as far as the 8-day moving average. So that build didn't take us very high, and the tape has turned weak again this afternoon. Now, Patrick, the U.S. government had previously announced intentions to fill the Strategic Petroleum Reserve by buying crude oil from U.S. producers. They withdrew those plans today. Apparently, they need to save their money so they can bail out the private jet business and the cruise ship business, and they don't have budget to fill up the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, taking advantage of bargain prices and helping out the hardworking men and women that keep the U.S. shale industry alive. Go figure on that one. It seems like apparently it just didn't pass somehow when they tried to push it through.
Eric, let's move on to gold, because what a recovery this week. Gold basically now racing the majority of the losses from the prior week sell-off. And what's your take on all of this?
People have said that the fiscal stimulus was bullish for gold. That's not right. Bullish is not right. Super bullish is not right. Uber bullish is not right. Patrick, there is no adjective in the English language that adequately describes how incredibly bullish the dual fiscal and monetary policy stimulus is for gold. You can't get more bullish than this. So I would say what's amazing is not the fact that we had this massive $200 rally just in a matter of a couple of days. I'd say what's amazing is how small it was, because there's plenty of fundamental rationale for this news to take us well north of $2,000 an ounce. So why didn't that happen? Well, it's the same reason that I've described before. We're still in a crisis situation. Now, right now, at this moment, stock market prices are just racing higher on what I believe is a misinterpretation of Neil Ferguson's latest announcement. And it actually looks, as we're recording, like maybe a top is in. It started to retrace about 20 points just in the time that we've been speaking. So we're going to have another big move down in stocks. At least that's my prediction. And when that happens, it could pull gold down with it for the same reasons it has before, which is correlations go to one in a crisis. There are rumors of Bridgewater puking gold, and perhaps Bridgewater is facing a lot of large redemptions from Saudi Arabia. That's the rumor anyway. That would mean that by the end of the month, Bridgewater has to sell a certain amount of gold, and they're certainly going to take advantage of high prices and sell. So that might be putting a cap on the move where it is. What's clear, though, is after the panic lows are in for stocks, after we get through this stock market crisis because of the coronavirus situation, eventually gold is going to scream higher, and not just to its recent highs, but much higher than that. The big question, of course, is do we still go down first, or do we just go straight up from here because this news is so profoundly bullish it just defies any adjective? I don't know. You know, I want to say there's still a chance that we're going to get a significant pullback, but my belief that we were going to get below 1350 because of the impact that I saw coming to the stock market, now that this news is out about the fiscal and monetary stimulus, I think it's hard for gold to go much lower than its recent lows.
Eric, we got several listener emails, and at the same time, we had seen several articles published this week about the breakdowns in the physical gold market and the paper price decoupling from the physical metal price. What's going on there?
Well, Patrick, that answer comes in two parts. The first part is an old story repeating that we've been through many times before. I can't believe that people keep falling for it, frankly. But current events do bring about a new story. So let's cover both halves of this. The old story is this. Anytime that there's any kind of crisis which creates a lot of demand for retail gold and silver coins and bars, the small silver and gold rounds and, you know, gold eagles and so forth, the various retail products, what happens is the physical dealers start peddling this bullshit story about how supposedly the paper price of gold has decoupled from the physical price because the system is failing and the end of the world is coming and the sky is falling and the secret cabal that is trying to manipulate the gold price is finally disintegrating. It's all a bunch of unadulterated bullshit. What's going on is the physical price of gold and the paper price of gold are exactly the same as long as we're talking about the physical price for 400-ounce London Good Delivery bars, the wholesale-sized piece of gold. What happens is those retail products, the small coins in retail bars, are in short supply. So what the dealers do is they price gouge. They mark them up dramatically. So suddenly there's a huge differential between the price of gold to buy London Good Delivery bars, the 400-ounce bars, and that's the same as the paper price that you see quoted. It's the same as the price that's reflected by the GLD ETF. You have to pay a great big premium in order to order gold eagles and other retail-sized coins because they're in short supply due to a temporary condition of strong demand. Rather than stock up and be ready for that strong demand, the dealers are smart enough to go the other way. They publish articles talking about how there's a breakdown between the gold price, the paper price, and the physical price. They make up all kinds of bullshit. It's not real, people. Don't fall for it. So that's the first part of the story. But in this coronavirus crisis, we really do have a part two to the story, which is there really are bona fide issues with getting good delivery bars, the 400-ounce bars, out of the London Bullion Market Association, because London, the city of London, is locked down because of the coronavirus crisis. So you can't deliver more 400-ounce bars from LBMA to the refiners that actually create those small retail coins and bars. If they can't buy more 400-ounce bars as their wholesale stock to make more coins and, you know, retail products from, then obviously the shortage intensifies. That allows them to price gouge even more and mark those retail products up to a huge premium over the actual price of gold. And in order to make you feel like you're not getting price gouged, they tell you this ridiculous story about how there's a breakdown going on between the physical price and the paper price, and you better move quick and pay that big upload in order to not miss your chance, because it might be impossible to ever get physical gold again if you don't act right now. It's all a bunch of nonsense. If you want to buy physical gold at the current paper price, it's very easy to do. You buy the GLD ETF. And by the way, folks, the physical gold that's owned by the GLD ETF is just as physical as the physical gold that you can buy in coins and bars. You sit on your GLD shares for a few months until this crisis has passed. And at that point, You sell the GLD shares and you use the money to buy your retail coins and bars at reasonable prices when that big premium comes out of the market. You have to believe that the whole system is failing and the world is coming to an end in order to not be able to see that that approach is better. Therefore, the dealers will tell you that the whole world is coming to an end. The sky is falling and you better move right now and pay that big premium. Otherwise, you're going to miss your chance. It's all a bunch of bullshit. Don't fall for it.
Eric, let's talk 10-year treasury yields. I mean, things have stabilized, but it still looks like those yields are holding their own. And are we going for another shot at zero here?
I don't know where we're going, Patrick. I'm at the point where I'm not trying to figure out that I know the answer. I'm better at asking the right question than knowing the answer myself, and I'm trying to ask it of the smartest people I can get my hands on. The question, and I'm convinced this is the question to ask, is are we seeing the beginning of the long-feared event where both stocks and bonds are going to sell off together at the same time, backing treasury yields up considerably from where they are here? I don't know the answer. I do know the consequences are staggering. If that is starting to happen, it means the whole institutional risk parity complex will have to be unwound, and that's going to have a really, really ugly impact on markets. So let's ask Simon White that question. He's better qualified to answer it than I am.
Yeah, so this week's featured interview guest is Variant Perception co-founder Simon White. Why did we invite Simon back as our guest this week?
Well, the Variant Perception guys in general are very data-oriented. They don't just go by the seat of their pants. They really work from hard data, and they do a lot of really great analysis. And they're also very good at understanding not just macro, but fixed income markets. And I think, as I just said in the discussion about where treasury yields are headed, that's a really important topic this week. So I'm looking forward to asking Simon about the monetary policy intervention. Now, the fiscal stimulus had not been announced when we taped this interview on Tuesday morning. But the discussion that we had about the monetary stimulus, I think, stands as a good proxy for how we can interpret the significance of the fiscal stimulus as well. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk on to risk off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your Research Roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Simon White is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Simon White, co-founder of Variant Perception. Simon, there's an old saying in finance that sometimes nothing happens for decades, and then there are weeks during which decades happen. I think this is one of those weeks. Monday morning, just after 8 a.m. this week, we got news that the Federal Reserve made what I think was the biggest monetary intervention announcement in recorded history, announcing unlimited quantitative easing to react to the coronavirus crisis. And specifically, you know, it was very, very controversial when QE2 was introduced several years ago. That was a spending program of $500 billion over the course of about 8 months. And it was very controversial. A lot of people thought that was just too much and they shouldn't do it. What the Fed announced this week is, first, they're going to spend more than that this week alone. And they're going to continue spending at that rate indefinitely. The thing that I think is even more, you know, we could do a whole show about that announcement, but what I think is even more newsworthy is the market's reaction. Of course, asset markets had to jerk higher on the news. That lasted, Simon, less than 2 hours before the move up in asset prices had fully retraced, which really speaks volumes in my mind. It says that the Fed put has finally expired worthless. Please give us your interpretation of these events and what are the knock-on effects and consequences as you expect them to play out in financial markets?
Well, thank you, first of all, Eric, for having me. I think that's an excellent starting question and one that can probably go down many different avenues. But I think the first thing you say is absolutely correct. This is a gargantuan move from the Federal Reserve. And what really this virus has exposed, in the same way it kind of ruthlessly exposes the comorbidities, that's existing conditions of people, it's exposed the comorbidities of the market. So in terms of broader Western markets that have been on a secular decline, you know, aging societies, essentially the virus is now just the kind of the trigger for the Japanification of the United States and of most of the Western countries. It also was the trigger for many of the underlying imbalances that all of us probably in the markets knew were building, essentially one giant short volatility position. So when it comes to the Fed, you know, monetary policy, it's been clear for some time, has been running out of road. And what happened over the last week is essentially they threw the kitchen sink at everything. And as you said, even this, in this particular situation, was not enough to salve people's confidence, which has been shaken. You know, the damage done to sentiment over the last few weeks is vast. And as part of the Fed's facilities, you know, as you mentioned, we've now got QE infinity. We've got forward guidance. I mean, I would be surprised if we ever leave the zero rate regime for the foreseeable future for many, many, many years. As a reminder, by the way, in Japan, when it went through a kind of seismic shift down in rates, the proximate cause there was the Kobe earthquake in 1995. They responded to that by slashing interest rates much lower, and interest rates have never seen these sort of levels again. You know, that was obviously 25 years ago. Fast forward to the US, you know, we've had a similar trigger event. No one knows what it's going to be, but it was vulnerable and the markets were fragile to that event. So the Fed has introduced swap lines. You know, we've been talking to our clients about the offshore dollar funding pressures that have been building. So far, this is, in that sense, it's not like 2008. 2008 was a broader dollar funding issue, onshore and offshore. And thus far, it's primarily been concentrated as an offshore problem. So the Fed has expanded its swap lines to kind of deal with that. We've had all sorts of the usual mortgage board of alphabet soup, if you like, of different facilities, commercial paper facility, the money market facility. And this was something that we were watching for, again, is the PMCCF and the SMCCF, which is the primary market corporate credit facility and the secondary market corporate credit facility. And these are really seismic moves. They've managed to get around not the, you know, adjusting the Federal Reserve Act. They're in special investment vehicles. But this really is the Fed stepping in straight to investment-grade businesses and essentially lending direct to them. And I think the one fundamental difference with 2008 is 2008, it was primarily a liquidity issue, and therefore the government or the central bank could rely on the banks to provide that liquidity to where it was kind of needed, and obviously to themselves that needed it. This time round, you know, even with all the guarantees, we have a solvency issue. So we have a whole bunch of companies and people essentially who, you know, money in, money out, and the money in was more than the money out, and they could keep things ticking over. And now we essentially have a whole bunch of companies that are essentially now just liabilities. And, you know, in the UK, for instance, we had a loan guarantee scheme. I don't think that'll work because the banks still have to keep 20% skin in the game. Now, if I'm a bank and a company comes to borrow from me and they say, look, we're losing £40,000 a week or whatever it might be, and that no one really knows how long this is going to go on for, even if I only got 20%, I'm probably not going to lend to them. So the logical conclusion of this is kind of what the Fed's just done, is you just have to lend to them direct. The same way in the UK, you know, there's no point in the US had a facility where essentially the government would lend companies money for them to pay their employees. We're going to work, they're just going to lay them off anyway, and the government has to pay them the unemployment benefits. In the UK, we just went straight to the shortcut and we're paying them direct. So again, you know, momentous changes are happening in front of our eyes and things that are going to, we're going to be living with the after effects for a huge amount of time. go back to the credit facility in the Fed, as I say, I think that's a seismic shift as well, but it's also what needed to be done. The credit markets are the most direct link between markets and the economies. And it's when you get these nasty kind of feedback loop developing between the two that you get recessions. And if the credit markets were allowed to kind of run rampant and allowed to continue to blow out as they were, then that's going to mean the recession is going to be much deeper and longer than anyone would like. One problem, of course, is all the kind of credit that's been issued or offered, sorry, to these companies, it's only investment grade. So that still leaves high yield, leveraged loans. Leveraged loans is now a bigger market than high yield. These aspects of the market are still in the lurch, you know, and as we speak, we're watching high yield spreads continue to blow out, and leveraged loans, you know, they're kind of harder to track because they're very illiquid, which is another major issue with where we've been in recent years. They are considerably under pressure as well.
Simon, you mentioned recessions. Now, I know you guys at Variant Perception do a lot of work modeling history and kind of evaluating how economic transition changes occur. It seems to me a recession is different from an exogenous shock, which is the way I would describe this event. Tell us a little bit about that. How do recessions and exogenous shocks compare, particularly with respect to whether the market anticipates them or not?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good question. And obviously where we are today, you know, very, very relevant. This is obviously a huge exogenous shock that may precipitate a recession. The way recessions tend to develop, as you say, we've done a lot of work in this, is they're not very linear processes. Like economies don't go from a non-recessionary to a recessionary state in a linear fashion. They do so in a highly non-linear fashion. And that's because you get these feedback loops developing between the real economy and between markets. Now, when it comes to an exogenous shock, that's obviously something, you know, like a true kind of black swan event. How markets respond to the two is actually very interesting. So if you look at previous historic shocks, for instance, if you look at World War One or Pearl Harbor or even the First Gulf War, what you needed to see was a material improvement in the exogenous shock before the market actually turned up. With recessions, however, the market basically is quite happy to kind of front run the business cycle. You know, markets are kind of quite comfortable, if you like, with a sort of run of the mill recession where you basically have the business cycle has turned down for one reason, say there's been a housing market blow up, and then you go through this recessionary process and then the market begins to turn up. So what you'll often see is the market tends to bottom before the recession is officially deemed to have ended. But with exogenous shocks, it doesn't work like that. So in World War One, they closed the market. They closed the market for, I think, 9 months. And actually opening the market was the kind of positive exogenous shock. The market kind of sold off for a little bit after that, and then it rallied, and it actually rallied all through the rest of the First World War, right through into 1918. Also, when you look at the Pearl Harbor, you know, obviously that was an exogenous shock in 1941. The market didn't begin turning up until there was a subsequent battle where the first kind of tactical advantage the US got over the Japanese. And after that, again, the market continued rallying all through the rest of the Second World War. Similarly, you know, in the First Gulf War in the early 1990s, the market didn't really start turning up until Operation Desert Storm. But with recessions, as I say, what you always see is that the market tends to turn up beforehand. And, you know, it's obviously, it might be a moot point right now whether we're going to see a recession. Obviously, the question is how deep and how long the recession is going to be. But, you know, we looked historically at pandemics. So there's been three major pandemics in the 20th century. Obviously, the Spanish flu in 1918, 1919, the so-called Asian flu in 1957, and the Hong Kong flu, which was in 1967. And all of these preceded recessions. Now, obviously, you never know exactly why the recession happened. You know, certainly the one at the coming out of the end of the First World War. I mean, you know, the economy was in a different state back then because of the war. But certainly the three previous pandemics we've had, there's been a recession that's closely followed. What's different today, of course, is we've never experienced such draconian response to a pandemic. And that's really going to really kind of forge how different the dynamic goes forward. So where we are today in terms of what's the market fixating on, the market seems to be fixating on the virus itself. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, to your first question, Eric, about why was what the Fed did, why did the market not immediately jump on that? I mean, obviously we're up today, but why did the market not immediately jump in that. And I think what the market really needs to see here is three things, really. A coordinated response between monetary policy, and as we've discussed, monetary policy is probably now shot all its bullets. We need to see fiscal policy, and unfortunately, there still seems to be some disagreement in Congress about getting a proper fiscal package through. You know, we are hopeful it happens relatively soon. You know, this happened back in 2008. The TARP bill didn't go through, I think, September 28, 2008, but a week later, October 3rd, it did go through. But also, third prong of that, there needs to be a real virus coordination response in the US. And that's obviously something that we have so far. You know, we've had very kind of draconian lockdowns in much of Europe. And so far, that's not been the case, certainly on a national basis in the US. And I think that's what's really needed to be seen before we get to any chance of what's going to be a probably intermediate bottom. Because I think we, given the damage done to sentiment, the chances are now we're in a bear market. And that means it's going to be very difficult to see a proper rise in markets for some considerable time.
Simon, a prediction that I've made for several years, I just had no idea what would cause it to someday come true, is that eventually, you know, we've been blowing simultaneous bubbles in both stock and bond markets for the last decade. And I thought someday something was going to happen that would cause both stocks and bonds to sell off at the same time, forcing the unwind of the institutional risk parity trade. Now, needless to say, risk parity is like the biggest thing in institutional finance. If it became necessary for institutions to unwind that trade, the market implications could be just profound in the sense of setting up a vicious cycle that reinforces that selling in both stock and bond markets. Now, in the beginning of this crisis, it seemed like not only could treasury yields only go down, but it was just, even for those of us who saw this event coming, we were just shocked at how quickly treasury yields collapsed. But all of a sudden, they started backing up. And it makes me wonder if we're seeing the beginning of that event where stocks and bonds both sell off, causing yields to back up considerably. Do you think that could be in play now? And how would we decide and monitor that? What clues should we watch in order to gauge whether that's starting to happen?
I think that's an excellent question, Eric. And I think it really gets to the heart of the matter. At the start of this conversation, you know, I mentioned that really the virus had kind of exposed a number of kind of imbalances within economies and within markets. And really one of the biggest imbalances that's kind of been brewing within markets has been this essentially a short volatility position. And one of the biggest, most egregious kind of exemplars of that is the risk parity trade. Now, these guys are essentially vol targeters, and they've been responsible for really keeping the market look like it's calm, if you like. They're creating this illusion of calm. And that's essentially because they are, you know, to use the parlance, they're kind of long gamma, which basically means that every time volatility goes down, they have to buy. And as they buy, that means volatility goes down further. So there's this kind of illusion of stability. But, you know, adhering to the work of Minsky, you know, stability breeds instability. And this has been brewing for several years now. And the risk parity strategies and risk parity like strategies, they're not insignificant. They're vast. You know, some estimate put them, you know, around about $1 trillion. And I think some of the more violent down days that we've seen in this sell-off have really been the risk parity guys de-risking. So interestingly enough, one of the worst days that we saw over the last few weeks was when the S&P breached 20% on a close-to-close basis. Now, this didn't happen in December 2018. And if it had have happened, we probably would have seen something similar back then. But we managed to just escape through the skin of our teeth. The S&P didn't quite sell down more than 20%. This time it did. And we just saw this cascade move taking us right through. And we're now obviously roughly down 30%. And so we're just seeing this very big unwind happening. You mentioned the bond yields. You know, that's part of it. Essentially, you have liability matchers, you have mortgage hedgers, and these guys have what's called negative convexity. And essentially what that means is when bonds go higher, they have to essentially buy more to match their liabilities. Now, what happened over recent weeks is the safe haven buying obviously fueled higher debt, and then these guys have to come in. And every time you got yields making a new low, you had them going through that low quite considerably. So essentially these guys were short gamma. And that's kind of what's happened, as I say, to use the parlance, is if everybody's long gamma, it's kind of self-equalizing. You have a stable equilibrium, if you like. And when everybody goes the other way and you have these short gamma trades, it means when price moves away from its equilibrium, people have to chase it away from that equilibrium. Stock buybacks is another example of that. That was something that was really keeping the market looking like it was stable. Basically, you had every time the market fell a little bit, these guys were in there always on the bid, always buying, and they support the market. So adding to that kind of long gamma thing. And what this really is dependent on, and this is what you mentioned in your question, Eric, is the fact that stock bonds correlations over the last 20 years have basically been negative. And that allows these strategies like risk parity to work. You know, they kind of work in the fact that one counterbalances the other, one asset counterbalances the other. But if you look back over history, stock bond correlation has been negative is an anomaly. You know, probably over the last 100 years, only 30% of the time have stock bond correlations been negative. And this is something we've been writing about. You know, this gradual shift to MMT, which has now overnight become a pretty much very sudden shift, is going to help push that stock bond correlation more and more positive. And that's something that we've been seeing over recent days. You know, we have had days where stocks and bonds have sold off at the same time. And this is just something that the market is not used to seeing. And this has, you know, very long-term kind of implications. You know, if we're moving towards a more MMT-like world, then there's certain relationships that everyone has got very used to have come to an end. We're in a different regime now. You know, so the long boom in financial assets will draw to a close and real assets will begin to outperform. So obviously things like precious metals, things like land, real estate, equities of companies that have access to real assets. So certain sectors like potentially like industry. We should also expect to see cross asset volatility should rise on average and also be subject to much more frequent episodic bursts higher because we just don't have these same people, your risk parity guys, your convexity hedgers there to stabilize the market like they once did. And it also means over the longer term, you know, that this whole leverage game is kind of up, right? So basically borrowing on a short-term basis, taking on leverage, is going to become over the next few years a much more dangerous game because the risk of real rates rising is much higher because the risks of inflation rising is now much higher. You have unprecedented amounts of stimulus that's going to hit economies and markets over the next in the coming years. And that's going to have a momentous effect on the economy, on the markets, and how people trade the markets.
Let's just talk about some of the mechanics of how this occurs, because what seems at the surface to just plain not make sense here is we had Treasury yields trading on their own before there was any stimulus introduced. Lower and lower and lower. We just couldn't believe it. 10-year U.S. Treasury is getting down. I think it was 31 basis points was the low. I don't remember what the number was, but really low. Now we've got the biggest monetary bazooka shot in recorded history. We've got unlimited spending from the Fed, and it's buying up bonds. Now, of course, it's lots of different maturities and so forth, but somehow that event has caused Treasuries, at least the 10-year yield, to move up. So is that all of the buying that the Fed is doing is in other maturities and it's leading people to the conclusion that it has to lead to inflation and that's why the 10-year is backing up? It just seems unbelievable that there could be so much government money being spent to buy bonds and bond prices are going down on the news. At least some bond prices are. How does that work?
It's exactly as you say. I mean, we're having to get used to inflation expectations again. For so long, they've been absent from longer term yields. I mean, if you look at the term premium, which is a reflection of inflation expectations, it's just been driven lower and lower and ever more negative in recent years. You know, that's one of the reasons why the curve couldn't steepen, the yield curve couldn't steepen. Even when the Fed was cutting rates, say, last year, we didn't see the curve steepen because every time they cut rates, term premium fell as well. And overall, the curve kind of didn't really do that much. Now we're in a different regime. You know, term premium now is going to start heading higher because people are going to start factoring in inflation expectations once again, because the entire investment universe, the entire structure of the financial world has now changed. You essentially have governments are going to step in. We're going to see most likely true forms of helicopter money, not pretend helicopter money, actual handing out checks to people to go and spend. We're seeing the Fed step directly in to lending to companies. All these things are going to lead to obviously a significantly higher budget deficit and significantly higher debt to GDP. And at that point, that's where you have to see inflation expectations rise. Now, gold, unfortunately, always gets buffeted around here. It's a bit like a kite in a hurricane sometimes, because a lot of your risk parity guys who we just discussed, their inflation hedge, unfortunately, was gold. Gold, and probably silver as well, are not particularly big markets. So these assets got knocked down pretty severely. But if you look at the way they've been trading over the last 2 or 3 days, they've been steadily rising. And I think this is just a reflection of the fact that we are moving to a different world. Inflation is going to be back. That's not to say it's going to be there permanently, or that's going to shoot up drastically higher straight away. But it means that the tail risks have shifted away from disinflation and deflation, which is essentially what central banks have spent the last 20 years micromanaging. And the tail risks are now going to shift to higher inflation. So we need to price inflation again. And the whole investment world over the last 20 years was kind of predicated, all the investment strategies was predicated under the fact that inflation was tamed and inflation was never going to be a problem again. But that's not going to be the case over the next 10, 15, 20 years.
Simon, I'd like to lay out my own personal thesis for what I think the next chapter of the coronavirus story is going to look like for the United States. Admittedly, some of this is my own opinion, but I'm really keen to get your reaction because you guys are so good at thinking through scenarios. And tell me how this might play out in markets if I'm right. Simon, what I see is the following. On Monday's press conference, all of a sudden, Fauci is not present, Birx is not present, and the Trump administration has changed their tune. Looks to me like maybe Lloyd Blankfein somehow got to Trump and persuaded him it's time to reopen the economy. So Trump makes a bunch of announcements saying, look, we're not going to shut down America. America was not meant to be shut down. And the reporters start asking him questions. Does Dr. Fauci agree with you on this? How come he's not here? And he was very evasive. He was intentionally saying, well, he didn't not disagree with me. You know, he wouldn't really answer the question directly as to why it feels to me like there has been a falling out between the medical advisors and the Trump administration members who are more concerned about the economy. What I'm afraid of, Simon, I've done a lot of research on this virus. I think we're headed down a path where the Trump administration is going to ignore its medical counsel and take us down the approach of we have to save the economy first. We can't shut down. I think, unfortunately, that will lead us to a situation where the outcome in the United States is not like Italy, but considerably worse than Italy. Because as much as the situation in Italy is awful, once they realized what was happening, they were pretty darn proactive in locking things down. The U.S. has taken the opposite approach of kind of making it optional. And I'm very concerned that if the Trump administration continues on the tack that I think they're on, we could have a closer to Wuhan level of event in the United States before they eventually realize the errors of their ways and lock things down and follow the hammer prescription from the Hammer and Dance article, which, by the way, listeners, is linked in your research roundup this week. Simon, if I'm right, I think what happens is we get a false relief rally because in reaction to what Trump says is going to happen, everybody thinks, okay, we're not going to have the shutdown after all. Eventually, it's going to lead to a much deeper shutdown, which is going to damage the economy even more, and I'm convinced do even more damage to markets. My question for you is, if I'm right about what I think is going on between Trump and his advisors, How far up can asset markets go on, you know, the leadership indicating that their intention is not to do this shutdown before the market eventually figures out that the shutdown is happening and will only be bigger as a result of this policy error?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that is obviously every country is trying to find their own way through this. And I think right now we're clearly in uncharted waters. So no one actually knows. I know that the UK was trying to steer the middle course the same way that the kind of the US is right now in terms of trying to delay the onset of more draconian measures with the belief that you only use them when you really need to. Because if you start too early and you enforce very kind of rigid quarantines,
people tend to relax after a while. And that's exactly the point when you don't want them to, because that's perhaps when the health service begins to become overwhelmed. I think what people are now watching quite closely, because, well, if you like, this is where the virus went global, is Italy. And really, as I say, we don't know. No one really knows how this is going to play out. But the one thing is, I guess, that all of us in the financial markets tend to trace data. We tend to follow data. And that's something that we can sort of look at and at least have some potentially sort of vague idea about what we think is going on. So the only thing I think that might be mitigating in terms of places like the US and the UK, I mean, in terms of assumptions they've used. So you mentioned the hammer and the dance that used an Imperial College paper that is basically what's guiding UK policy right now. And, you know, some of the assumptions we don't know, but I think we have to be aware that every country is different. You know, in Italy, for instance, the spread may have been greater for a number of reasons, you know, more interpersonal contact, more intergenerational contact. You know, they've got the second highest median age. Also, even if you look at, quite interestingly, if you look at the size of the household. So when you go into a lockdown, essentially your R0, your kind of transmission rate, really it becomes much more important about who's in the household. So you try and limit people's activities outside, then obviously that part of your R0 is less relevant. And the part that's more relevant is how many people live in your house. Now, in Hubei, in China, the average household has 3 people, which is quite high. In Italy, it's 2.58, whereas in the US, it's 2.52, slightly lower. But there's a big range there. So in Utah, there's 3.12, all the way down to Maine, which has 2.18 people. And the one that's kind of worrying to me is California is quite high. Obviously, California being the most populous state, it's 2.96. So we have to see exactly how that plays out. Like the strength of the quarantining needs to be more serious, more aggressive, if you like, in the places that have a higher household number, because the WHO estimated that in China, 80% of transmission after lockdown came from households, from people in the households. So how it's going to play out in different countries is I think, going to vary. And that's something that will come very apparent in 2 weeks. I think we're all hopeful. We're all on the same page that we just don't want to see it get into the Italian stage, where what happens is once the health service becomes overwhelmed, then your death rate rockets up, not purely because of the disease itself, but because anyone in a fragile state, whether they have COVID or not, suddenly becomes hugely more vulnerable. So I think, you know, as far as the market goes, it will be keeping a close eye, obviously, on what happens in Italy, the UK and the US. But I, going back to my exogenous shocks analogy, yes, I think we need to see a material improvement before the market can actually have any chance of bottoming. And the problem with this sort of exogenous shock is no one really knows how long it's going to go on for. And in that sense, we're really in bear market territory, because in bear market territory, people's confidence gets shot so many times. We see so many rallies, and the rallies in bear markets can be massive. I mean, in the 1990s in Japan, we saw 30 to 50% rallies, but they tend to, you know, ended up being nothing and the market reversed. So bear markets do a huge amount of damage. You know, the average bear market length in the US is 18 months and the average decline is 42%. So I think we're roughly 30% now, but in terms of timeline, this has happened very, very swiftly. So, you know, I think we're in agreement, Eric, in terms of if there is going to be some sort of bottom, there's a good chance it's an intermediate bottom. The real bottom comes when everybody has tried to buy the market. They've been massively disappointed and we get to the point of kind of revulsion. You know, you won't touch the market even with a full hazmat suit on. And that's the point where you really want to buy the market. But it does feel like we're kind of a long way from that just yet.
Well, I strongly agree with you on that. I don't think that we're anywhere close to the final bottom. What I'm starting to think is that we're maybe at the beginning of a significant bear market rally driven by what seems to me to be a change of sentiment in the Trump administration, that they're going to maybe not pay as much attention to the medical advisors and focus more on the economic advisors. And I fear that that is going to be a very fatal strategy, but it could allow markets to correct up on false hope considerably from here. Simon, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Before I let you go, for any listeners who are maybe not familiar with Variant Perception and what you guys do there, tell us a little bit about the firm and the services that you offer.
Oh, thanks, Eric. Yeah, so Verint Perception, we've been around for about 10 years now. We really emphasize the fact that we have a data-driven approach, and we sort of take the outsider perspective to stuff. So, you know, rather than us trying to pretend to be experts in X, Y, and Z, we really take a very agnostic approach to markets and to economies and use that to really come up with some of the best ideas. So we have many subscribers across the whole gamut, you know, from asset managers to hedge funds to high net worth individuals. And, you know, we write regular reports and we also have regular contact with our clients. And really, we're trying to really help them try and find the best trading ideas. So if you're interested, have a look at our page, variantperception.com, and you can sign up for a trial there.
Fantastic. We look forward to getting you back on in a few months for another update. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message. This episode of Macro Voices was sponsored by my own vacation rental on the coast of Maine. It's a 5-acre oceanfront family compound with a deep water dock, 2 separate residences, 2 kitchens, and 8 king and queen bedrooms. But with all the pull-out sofas and bunk beds, we can actually sleep upwards of 30 people in a pinch. You couldn't imagine a better safe haven to ride out the COVID-19 crisis than this property. It's extremely rural. You couldn't ask for better social distancing. And it features sunsets over the ocean and has a great big rec room with a pool table, home theater, and super fast 100 megabit cable internet to keep you connected to both Netflix and financial markets. I'd like to find a tenant for the duration of the COVID crisis. This property would be ideal for someone with a big family who wants to get out of New York City and ride the crisis out in the countryside. To be clear, this property is currently booked in July and August, so I'd have to renegotiate with my current reservations, but I don't think that would be too hard given the circumstances. Now, this is a big place, 5 acres of oceanfront, 2 residences, and accommodations for up to 30 people. So it's not cheap, $1,000 a night during high season. But if your family can afford to live in New York City or Boston, you can probably afford to get out of the city for this crisis, which I strongly recommend. If you're interested, please email me via info@macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Simon. I put together this chart book in the post game, and it really was inspired by when I was listening to Simon. He was talking about the average length of bear markets and the duration of bear markets, and also the idea of the sentiment that is associated around them. And so I wanted to just take a dive into that.
And listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com. Click the red button that says looking for the downloads next to Simon White's picture. Patrick, let's go ahead and dive in here on page 2. This is definitely the operative question. How high do typical bear market bounces go? Because I'm convinced that's what this is. This is a bear market rally, and boy, it's a screamer of a bear market rally. 200 points just today on what I think was a misinterpretation of Neil Ferguson's statements. How much higher can we go from here?
I approach the markets a little bit differently than you. I mean, to you, it's really important, each headline on this. For me, I really kind of look at market structure a little bit differently, and the reflexivity of markets from when you have such an extreme move, then what's their natural responses the other way. And so to me, one of the best ways to approach this is to really just take some of the past bear markets and how they played out. And what I thought was important, like Simon was talking talking about it, just what the average length of a bear market has been. And let's be realistic. If this bear market ended just like 1 month in, it would probably be one of the shortest bear markets of all time. And I'm with you that this hasn't fully played out. But we are definitely in a bear market bounce. And it was interesting. I was looking at the 1929 analog, but I mapped on page 3 the 2008-2009 one. But both of those had one characteristic that was particularly interesting to kind of compare to today. In 1929, while it took the first wave of selling 2 months to fully play out, it was a 45% decline over 2 months. In the middle of it was this 3-week decline that wiped out about 35% in a very short order. And after that first wave of massive selling in 1929, it also had afterwards a 50% retracement of the prior sell-off. And similarly on this page, what I'm showing is the Lehman moment of 2008-2009. And some will argue that I should have been measuring the bear market from its highs when it started in late 2007. But really what I wanted to capture was the Lehman moment was a 35% drop in the stock market that started through September into October that lasted 21 days, wiping out 35%. What happened in the subsequent days after was a 3-day bounce that erased 50% of the drop. It was a 27% rise off of the bottom to the top. And that was just a reflexive move. Nothing dynamically changed in my mind during that Lehman sell-off. It's just what markets do. After you have such a severe sell-off, the market has an opposite reaction that retraces that way. And what's interesting is that within a couple weeks, not only was the S&P 500 back down to the lows, but it was even making lower lows within a month. And the entire sell-off that followed that Lehman moment took almost 6 months to reach the ultimate bottom, which from that the start of that move was a 48% decline that took about 168 days, just under 6 months in length. And so what I thought was really interesting is that here you had this big, huge bounce that was just reflexive from the magnitude of the selling, but it still didn't stop the bear market from continuing on once that bounce ran out of steam. And so what I did on page 4 was to kind of just overlay what would be the analog if it played out the way it did in 2008-2009. Now, immediately, I just need to make this clear to listeners. I'm not forecasting that it's going to play out the same as 2008-2009, but I think it's a really interesting storyline to kind of allow yourself mentally to think through what are the different scenarios and how they're likely to play out. And so what we had was this 32-day sell-off that basically wiped out the 36% on the downside during this COVID-19 moment, we call it. And we're in the midst of some sort of a bounce. And if we followed the same type of a 50% retrace that we have seen in both 2008 and 1929, in each scenario, if we did a similar bounce, that this rally that we're seeing that's now north of 2,600 will end by 2,800 on the S&P. And if you think about it, we're almost there. I mean, there isn't much left in the tank. I mean, yeah, we made 200 points in one day. I mean, we might be, even if it does manage to muster up another 100 or 200 S&P points, there isn't much left to be made on the upside relative to what we've already seen off of the low. And so one has to taper their enthusiasm of how much you're pressing the upside from here, because it's no longer asymmetric in catching the bounce anymore. But if it followed that, then by April into early May, we would be making still a lower low, and then it would bleed out into August if it followed that storyline. Again, it's not a forecast, but it'll be interesting to see whether or not a bear market driven by this COVID-19 has in some sort of like echoes to what we saw back then.
Well, Patrick, my reaction to that is I think we really have to focus on the question of, is this just a COVID-19 event, or is COVID-19 the pin that popped the bubble and there it started a process in motion which has to play out because it's already begun? If you think it's just a COVID-19 event, then I think the time schedule has to be compressed a little bit, because even as much as you might say, oh, okay, well, it takes 6 months, according to your chart here on page four, to really get to the ultimate bottom. I think what's going to happen is we are going to be absolutely horrified by what's about to happen in the United States. We're going to get to triage, where we have to shut people off and literally allow them to die because we can't give medical care to everyone. That's all coming by the end of April. And I think that it's around the end of April where we get to the maximum point of new infections that probably brings about the COVID-19 market bottom, I think probably by the 1st of May. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't get, just as you have here, a bounce to where everybody thinks maybe it's over, and then you realize, no, wait a minute, it's not just about COVID-19. COVID-19 is what popped the bubble, and we've still got further to go. So whether or not you get that last red arrow down on page four that you've got drawn in here, I think depends entirely on whether or not popping the bubble is going to have a life beyond just what the virus itself does. Because I think the virus crisis will be ending by the time we get to this, you know, 6 month time frame that you're showing here.
Right. So I do believe, though, that this is going to be more than about the COVID-19, because it's going to take a while to restart the economies. And even though we're going to see huge fiscal spends coming in globally, this is not even about the fiscal spends in the U.S. There's just going to be huge government spending to try to restart the global economy. And I just don't think it's going to happen as fast as everyone thinks. And so we're going to have to get used to a lot of negative data and things moving a little bit slower than everyone expects. And that could be an emotional drag that keeps the sentiment pretty negative and allows a bear market to perpetuate.
I couldn't agree more, but I just think it's a question of separating what the virus does and then what the market does, not directly driven by the virus. The part that's driven by the virus, I think that plays out through April and May, and by the end of May, hopefully, it's ending. Let's move on to gold on page five.
Right. And that's just showing the gold chart that you already covered quite extensively in the market wrap. So I don't have too much more to say on that. But what I wanted to really was show page six, which was the material decoupling of gold and silver. Now, during that crash, silver more or less, well, not more or less, it did crash below its bear market lows throughout 2015 and 16. I mean, you have to go all the way back to 2008 to see silver prices where we were trading. And what's amazing is that while gold fully recovered on that bounce, silver is still down on the year and has had no relative strength whatsoever to that. And one of the more interesting things that I'm going to be watching is how long does silver materially underperform gold? And will we see a situation where, let's say, gold first begins to rally and silver just lags and lags, and then suddenly everyone just all at once brings silver to in a one big epic rally back up toward gold? It'll be interesting. It's one of the things that we're definitely watching. What's your take on that?
Well, I definitely think it's very important for our listeners to pay attention to. You know, if you feel like, boy, I didn't buy my gold at $14.50. I was hoping that maybe weakness in the stock market was going to pull it lower, and I just missed that rally. Well, you didn't. You missed a rally in silver, but the rally in silver only took you back up to, you know, a long way down from where you would expect it to be. So it seems like, I think the gold-silver ratio actually hit an all-time record recently. It seems like maybe the value play is to buy silver instead of gold if you feel like you're a little bit late to the party at these gold prices.
Well, that has to be the case for sure. Assuming that silver inevitably will play the role of the little cousin to gold, then silver is definitely the value play for sure. So what I wanted to move on is chart seven. I wanted to look at those 10-year yields. And there's no shortage of the bulls on the bonds taking a victory lap. And now there's a number of them that are suggesting that we could see zero interest rate yield on the 10-year. And listen, I've been a bond bull for a long time, and I'm not ready to turn on the bond bulls, but I've slowly am curtailing my enthusiasm. I'm taking an incredibly neutral state. I'm not bearish bonds outright yet, but I'm not that bullish either. And one of the reasons I wanted to show is on page 8, which is looking at inflation expectations. This is just using that ProShares inflation expectation ETF. But since the QE Infinity was announced, we saw inflation expectations just rocketing higher. And the way I always look at it is that there are two major, at least to me, there are two major things that I track for influences on bonds. And that is, number one, monetary policy. But number two is commodity prices, such as oil and stuff. And so right now, what we're seeing is commodity prices continue to be incredibly depressed, even though inflation expectations because of the monetary policy are rocketing higher. And so what's really interesting is, could we see a scenario still where financial repression allows or pushes the 10-year yield towards zero? Or is it that we're going to see finally inflation start creeping in from all this money printing, and that this very bearish looking 10-year yield chart just does not end up making that move to zero? It's certainly something that I'm going to be watching.
Patrick, on page 9, you've got the twos, tens yield curve. And boy, as I look at this, I can see Charlie McElligott's bearded face saying, fear the steepener. What's going on here?
Well, that's exactly it, right? The steepener's on. And so what we had was obviously the bull steepening kick in as we saw the rate zero. So now this is all about the long end of the curve. And so if and when inflation starts to rear its head, and it at some point when it starts to be pressed into the 10-year yield, we can see the steepener really start to kick in. And we've seen a legitimate breakout. And it's one of the things that I'm watching, because like Charlie said, right, you fear the steepener. And is this a true breakout of the steepener? It really feels like it, doesn't it?
Well, Patrick, it sure looks that way to me. If ever, as I said, a chart looked like the steepener was on, this is the one. I want to call our listeners' attention also to page 10, where we've got information about your own services. Patrick, if anybody hasn't tried a free subscription to Big Picture Trading yet, I highly recommend it. You get a webinar with Patrick almost every single day, a live Q&A and weekly position summary, and a whole bunch more. So be sure to check that out on page 10. Go to bigpicturetrading.com and sign up for a free trial. This episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit MacroVoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they missed in this week's Research Roundup.
So this week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Simon White, as well as the link to the charts we just discussed here in the post game. There's also a link to an article from Nouriel Roubini titled A Greater Depression, and an article looking back and ahead on this liquidity crisis. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MBRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.